Hi, it's Bob from Royal Spa. Soaking in a hot tub full of Epsom salts is the absolute best way to minimize everyday aches and pains. And we know all about Epsom salts at Royal Spa. Royal Spa hot tubs are the only hot tubs on the market that can safely and effectively use Epsom salts. Made right here in Indiana, Royal Spa hot tubs are the highest quality hot tubs on the market. Visit any one of our three Indianapolis locations or visit royalspa.com.
Ah, Royal Spa.
A week from Thursday, the countdown to pick 15 in the NFL draft begins for your Indianapolis Colts as we continue to sift through mock drafts and get you set for next Thursday here on Query & Company. Joining us now, he is Lance Zierlein, NFL Network analyst, a part of the wall-to-wall NFL Network live coverage from April 25th to the 27th at the 2024 NFL Draft. Lance, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your time as always. And diving right in, because of all the mocks that we've seen, you're the first one in your write-up, your Lance Zierlein 3.0 mock draft that released just a couple of days ago. You're the first one in your write-up on the Colts that acknowledges the fact that it is a real challenge to figure out what the Colts are going to do at 15. You go to a spot, though, where I agree with the write-up that it would be impactful and it fits the Colts, historically speaking, in the Ballard era, but I feel like wide receiver and corner is the area Colts fans really want to see happen. You have them taking Byron Murphy the second out of Texas, the defensive tackle. If they do go that route, to temper the maybe frustration of Colts fans wanting, you know, a more sexy, impactful position, what would a guy like Byron Murphy the second up in the trenches with DeForest Buckner do for the Colts defensively?
Well, look, we can talk the football side of it. DeForest obviously signed a contract extension after the mock draft came out. But, you know, I know Ballard, and Ballard loves guys that play like Byron Murphy, loves guys that look the way he does. It's impactful. He's one of the rare defensive tackles in this draft with an ability to impact the game on all three snaps, can penetrate. He's strong at the point of attack for his size, stronger than his listed weight, can rush. You know, Chris loves guys who can rush from the interior. But, you know, I don't think that would be the pick now. But if he made that pick, it would certainly create a three-man rotation up front that would be a terror for teams. And, I mean, you'd be able to truly rush the passer from the interiors probably better than any team in the league. So he would be – he'd be a great fit for the Colts. But as you mentioned, and I mean, you know, I'm trying to think like the Colts will think. In my mock drafts, I try to think like teams would think. Listen, you need wide receiver, you need corner. There's just no way around it. The question is, when are the Colts gonna prioritize that? When's the last time Chris drafted a cornerback in the first round? When's the last time he came from a team in Chicago years ago with Lovie Smith that they didn't draft corners in the first round? They found guys outside of the first to play in the system. Now maybe that's obviously changed over the years, but from a wide receiver standpoint, yeah, they could use an impact player at wide receiver. I think that, you know, you have three good wide receivers, but you want to get more out of Alex Pierce. Love Josh Downs. The Colts would have pulled the trigger earlier on Tank Dell. That would have been an interesting selection in the second round. But now looking at wide receiver, there's only one wide receiver you take there probably, and that would be Brian Thomas. So I think Adunze will be gone. I don't know if Chris would trade up or not. So it's tough. It's really tough figuring him out because he believes in the trenches so much, offensive line, defensive line. But at the same time, we all know that you got to get better in coverage and you got to get better. You need another high-impact playmaker. And, you know, I look at Brock. I think Brock Bowers would be a tremendous selection for the Colts because you look at Brock and he would be a guy that would give Anthony Richardson a safety blanket, somebody you throw basic quick throws to and let him do his thing after the catch, which is why he's so special. He's also tough getting down the field. He's an average blocker. I think that sometimes it's made too much of how he's this great blocker. He's not a great blocker. He's average blocker by NFL standards. But Bowers would be – that was my first selection for the Colts when I did my mock draft. But I just think Bowers is probably going to be gone. But if he's not gone, I definitely think the Colts could end up looking at him as a pass catcher. Maybe not a wide receiver, but a pass catcher and a playmaker, he still fits in that category for the Colts.
When it comes to building in the trenches, and I get it, Lance Zierlein, and there's no doubt, I mean, Chris Ballard favors that, right? at some point, yeah. And is it too harsh of me to say this? At some point, you got to look at it and go, you know what? We've been committed to the trenches and getting edge rushers and building on the lines and everything else, and we're 54-60-1 with one playoff win. Let's take some chances here. Let's go after it, and let's finally get this bad boy in open road and see what we can get out of it. Is the time now?
I mean, I think it is, provided the right guys there. I never believe in just going in with a mentality, because if there's not the right people around there, you can go in with a mentality, and then you're swinging at false gold, like you're swinging at mirages. You've got to have the right pieces. You've got to go after the guys that you believe are the right guys for that team. At the Colts, you want to see a little bit more. You'd love to see a guy you'd love to see Quiddy Pay develop into a 13-sack player, right, off the edge. You'd love one of these early draft picks to turn into a big, massive, high-impact player. I know where you're going, because there's a lot of good players, but you want the big, highlight, explosive player to come out of there. And I think, you know, one mode of thinking is you go get an offensive lineman, you make your offensive line as good as possible, you're protecting your quarterback, and you beat the brains out of people with Jonathan Taylor, who you just got done paying, in the running game, and you make things easier for your quarterback. And, you know, I totally get that. I understand that, too. You can find playmakers in the second and third rounds at wide receiver. You absolutely can. I don't love the tight ends necessarily once you get past Bowers as much. But wide receiver-wise, man, you got some guys that can really run, that can stretch the field, that can have a big impact on games. So you don't have to have that in the first round. I think the problem comes at cornerback. You know, if you had a chance at Quinyon Mitchell, I would love – and my son, since, you know, my son is Ballard's his godfather, so just, you know, I'm perfect just to be full transparency. I live in Houston. I cover Houston sports, including the Texans, when I'm not doing my draft stuff. And my son is a big Colts fan, and he's so mad that the Texans had their free agency and that the Colts did not match in free agency. But if they drafted Quinyon Mitchell, I'd tell my son, man, you should be really happy, because the Colts just picked up a really talented cornerback that I think has a chance to, you know, turn into a special player in the future. But, you know, will he be there? We'll see. I think there's a pretty decent chance he could be there. Will Brian Thomas Jr. from LSU be there? There's definitely a chance he could be there too.
Thomas Jr. to me, I think, would be really tempting. Now, I want to know now, like, when you guys are discussing things about your son then, so who does Ballard tell you he's going to take?
He doesn't. Anyways, I've argued with him in the past. I've known Ballard for 18 years. And when he lived here in Houston, was a scout for the Bears. And, you know, he tells me, oh, you don't know. Oh, you don't know. Land, I'll be in text strings before with him where he'd try to bully me.
Does he have his arms crossed when he says that?
Oh, and I showed him the Ballard. Somebody put together a Chris Ballard press conference bingo card. It was phenomenal. And I showed it to some of the other guys with the Chiefs. I mean, with the Colts, because it's, you know, Chris is an open book. I mean, one of the best people that you'd ever find in the world. But he is also very, he's pretty guarded with who he likes. But he also is honest, and I know what he likes. It's just a matter of kind of guessing with him. And even if he told me who he likes, which he doesn't, even if he told me who he liked, it still doesn't matter, because he's going to draft according to how the board rolls out.
Well, I was going to say, it depends on who's there, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it really does. That's why I say, you know, you never say no on a guy like Byron Murphy. You never say no on a tight end. I just know he's adherent to his philosophies, and I think he may have to bend it a little bit this year if he's going to take receiver or corner.
Do you, Lance, let me ask you this. Lance Zierlein is our guest. From a national perspective, I'm curious of this, because I think sometimes we get caught up in our own snow globe, right? So my curiosity would be this. How close is Indianapolis? Like, if you're an NFL team and you're starting on the East Coast and building yourself to the point of being a Super Bowl contending full roster means that you have gotten to California. Right now, Chris Ballard is driving a car that is at what part of the United States? They are how close?
Like Nebraska.
Okay.
I mean,
a little past halfway, right? I mean, 60%
well,
there.
Well, until you know what you have with Anthony Richardson, it's an impossible question to answer. And I say that with the hindsight of seeing what C.J. Stroud did. Special year from C.J. Stroud. But you also have to remember, this is an organization, and Chris has done a good job of building an organization that has real football guys in it, like guys who love football, Football character is very important in that building. And whether you work there or whether you're a coach there, whether you're a player there, you know, you got to be all in and you got to be one as part of one group. And, you know, they don't like the turmoil. I've been watching the Texans forever, and it was a disaster from ownership to the Bill O'Brien era, like an utter disaster. And I looked at the Colts as that's the right way to do it. But now with one hiring of DeMeco Ryans and with the drafting of a great quarterback in C.J. Stroud and an absolute leader and dog in Will Anderson, they've really changed culture pretty quickly. So C.J. Stroud showed me what is capable of happening if you get the quarterback right. And so now we just have to see if Anthony Richardson's a guy and how quickly can he come along, because, you know, he has a lot of talent, but there's still a lot of bumpy patches that he's going to have to work out. And not being able to play a full year last year, man, that really, you know, when it comes to quarterbacks, Colts have had some bad luck. And I think that injury to Anthony Richardson, you know, it starts with him staying healthy, but it's impossible to say where they are. I mean, from a talent standpoint, Texans and Colts rosters, they're not that dissimilar. But once you have the quarterback, it changes everything. I mean, once you have quarterback, now I would also argue that maybe Stephon Diggs has really given a big advantage to Houston from a skill position standpoint. But it's all about the quarterback once you get good pieces around. And Colts have some pretty good pieces, but they got to be able to cover a little better. And then, you know, you're going to have to find explosive plays, because Richardson's not just going to be able to sustain 12 and 13 play drives. I mean, not unless Jonathan Taylor's a monster.
You know, I've driven across Nebraska. It takes a long time, Lance.
It does. It never changes. It looks like Kansas and Nebraska stay the exact same for a long time.
You're like, wait a minute, we're still driving. It's been a day. That's probably what it feels like sometimes building a roster, right? Hey, in your opinion, when you look at, because it's been a long time here, you know, obviously for the Colts, you have the Andrew Luck period, and there was very little acclimation. I mean, he found footing right away. Peyton Manning probably took a year, and then but you could see the flashes. In your opinion, Anthony Richardson has essentially played the equivalent of three full games. It takes how many games for quarterbacks to see all the different looks that are going to be thrown their way and for defenses to see all the tendencies of a quarterback so that you can then say, okay, now we have a general idea who this guy is? That takes how many games?
For the opposing team on a quarterback, did you say, or the team?
Either way, I mean, before you from the outside can say.
I mean, you're not going to – yeah, it's kind of a loaded question, because part of it is, so it's multifaceted. How do you handle adversity? When do you face your first true adversity? How do you handle, you know, rolling coverages and disguise coverages? How do you handle a team that's a blitz-heavy team? Like, there's really a lot that goes into it. There's different types of defenses they have to see. There's different types of coverage schemes. There's going to be, you know, how do you deal with blowing a lead in the fourth quarter? Can you come back and lead a team down to the end? Can you play hurt? You know, I hurt my knee, didn't feel great. My ankle got that rolled up on. How do you play when you're injured and you're hurt? There's a lot that goes into it. And how do the players gravitate towards you? I've heard nothing but great things about the way the players look at Anthony Richardson. So I think that's fantastic. But I'm just telling you, not being able to get that full year in for Richardson to go through his highs and lows and the very things I'm talking about, it's a killer, because you can't accelerate that process. You just have to – the process is the process, and experience can't be faked. You just have to go through it. And so I think the Colts are going to know – I think the Colts have obviously a better idea of who – I can tell you this. They're very happy with Anthony Richardson. I can tell you that. I don't feel like I'm breaking any covenant here. They like him a lot, and they feel like they 100% got that pick right. But there's still football stuff that has to be experienced and learned. And no matter how much you like him, he still has to get through the tough times. And I think what the job is of Shane and the job is of Chris Ballard, and the job is to make him as comfortable as possible with the talent around him and the scheme, while at the same time asking him to do things that are uncomfortable. So you want to make it as favorable as you can around him, which is why you and I are talking about wide receivers, why I think Brock Bowers would be a terrific selection, but why it's important to be able to limit the amount of points you have to put on a board to win a game. It's all very important to make things, the life a little, to make that growing process a little more comfortable for him, because he's going to be uncomfortable enough as it is game in and game out. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing to be uncomfortable.
NFL Network analyst Lance Zierlein is our guest. He'll be a part of NFL Network's wall-to-wall live coverage of the 2024 NFL Draft. We mentioned a week from Thursday, April 25th through the 27th. Lance, throughout the last 14, 16 months, Chris Ballard has made it clear in regards to Anthony Richardson that they're not going to try to, with the phrase he uses, make him be Superman. They're not going to put undue pressure on him, too high of expectations out of the gate. You've mentioned this a couple times in regard to where the Colts are structured. I know you mentioned your son's a Colts fan and perhaps, you know, a little frustrated with the lack of external.
He's a psychopath. I mean, an absolute psychopath. Well, when the Texans signed Danielle Hunter, it was like, God, he threw a temper tantrum outside.
He is a microcosm, I think, of the entire Colts fan base when stuff like that happens. But to your point, though, when they have not done anything largely externally to this point, and let's say they do focus defense early, because that's an area of need for certain on this team going into 2024. But if they delay on adding offensive help for him, are you not inherently putting undue pressure on your quarterback?
I think yes. Well, so
like you're making him press, you know what I mean? Like you're putting him in situations.
I look at it differently because I think this is a great draft for wide receivers in the second and third round. So I think the question you're asking me, I have to know, you know, to me, I think addressing on day two wide receiver or tight end, you know, that would be the same for me as maybe looking in the first round. It's there's no one right way to do things. And when you look at draft histories and you go see where players were drafted and how successful players drafted behind another player were, right now this is just opinions and slotting based on, you know, what we think people who do this from an amateur standpoint. But team boards look substantially different than what public boards look. They're much, much different because they know about people's personalities, their injury history. There's a lot of things. They'll meet with them and they may not like a player, may not like the personality, may get bad reports on a player from their coach, you know, at where they came from. So I do think that if you stay exactly the same, And you didn't draft anybody on offense? Yeah, absolutely. I do think there's some offensive help needed. I think offensive line is a position I would probably take a look at along with either a tight end, a pass catching tight end, or a wide receiver. You know, another target, so to speak. Absolutely, I think it'd be wise to give Alex Pierce some competition out there. I mean, you know, hey, I love that he can run deep, but it's just you're not getting enough productivity out of him right now. And you know who Pittman is on the other side, but he's going to hit you for a lot of, you know, he's never going to average 17 yards a catch in the NFL. So, but I think if you added it, and I'm just going to give you a random name, let's say Roman Wilson out of Michigan. Well, he's got 4.3 speed and can work all three levels and can play from the outside and the inside. And you got him in the second round, or maybe even early third, that'd be great. I think that'd be a great selection by the Colts. Tank Dell was a third round pick for the Texans and had 7 touchdowns in the first 9 games he played. Like, he was a monster. So you can find him. You can find him. But a lot of that's going to be on Shane Steichen to design an offense that really accentuates Anthony Richardson's positive attributes. And let's face it, they got to run the ball. I mean, we can talk about wide receivers as much as we want, but the best tonic for a quarterback who is going through the learning process is being able to be in short yardage situations, being ahead of the sticks. And the best way to do that is some of the flashes. We finally saw the offensive line play better last year, and we saw Jonathan Taylor start to flash again. Got to get that back, man. You got to get that 2,000-yard Taylor back. He may not run for 2,000, but you got to have that ability to impose your will and put Anthony Richardson in second and 5, third and 3, because then you really open up the playbook and make it harder on defense as you keep him on the back foot.
Lance, if your son, the football maniac, wanted to be drafted in this year's draft, his best opportunity to do so would be to play what position, because it's the one that is the thinnest, and as a result, he'd have a chance to slide right in?
Ooh, I mean, he's like 5'7", 120 pounds right now. He hadn't hit his puberty yet, so I don't love him playing a defensive tackle spot at this point. I'd say safety. Not a good safety draft. Very light. That would give him his best shot, and he has no shot. So let's just say his best shot.
His but best he's got shot a shot, would be right?
Safety, because it's just not a very good safety draft. So That would be the spot. Safety, and frankly, corner's not a great. That's why if the Colts are to draft a corner, it's probably going to happen in the first two rounds because it's just not a very deep corner draft.
It would be awkward if your 5'7", 140-pound kid was drafted as a safety and then says to Roger Goodell, I wanted the Colts hat! Come on.
Oh, no, and he'd say that. He'd show his disdain just like he shows to me and his mom whenever we ask him to pick his shoes up.
Beautiful. Lance, we appreciate it. I know you're busy. It's a busy time of year, so appreciate the perspective. Look forward to having you on again, but I appreciate the time today.
All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Lance Zierlein, again, joining us. It's going to be night fever. It's going to be day fever. It's going to be whatever day they're playing for the Indiana Fever here in central Indiana. Caitlin Clark fever is sweeping across, as it has been for quite some time, the country. Last night, of course, that is the big news, the number one overall selection in the WNBA draft. Joining us now to talk about that and more is the general manager of the Indiana Fever, Lynn Dunn. And Lynn, I will get to the obvious question right off the top, and that is, tell me what you like about Celeste Taylor and Leilani Correa, your second and third round picks.
Both very athletic, both slashers that can hit the three, high intensity, big time motor, come from outstanding programs at Ohio State and Florida, so will be a great addition to our franchise.
And then there's that first pick, Caitlin Clark. I remember a couple of months ago we had you on, and I said you've already got some Boston baked beans in the inside in Aaliyah Boston, and now you've got a Clark candy bar. And you said, I love Clark candy bars, and you knew that that was going to be a great candy combination. Tell me why this combination is going to be sweet and how long it's going to take to really get it to mesh together.
Yes, and I really love Clark candy bars. I really do. I think it's a natural. You know, I think back to when I coached Sue Bird and Lauren Jackson, and they took the Seattle Storm, I think, to four championships. And I think they're going to be great in the pick and roll, the pick and pop. They're really going to complement each other.
I'm curious of this, Lynn, and Lynn Dunn is our guest. Look, Caitlin Clark is obviously a dynamic and transcendent personality, you know, and player. You know, my dad, for example, my dad sent me a text after the national championship game in women's basketball and said, you know, I've got to thank Caitlin Clark because I don't know that I truly appreciated just how great the women's game is and how much he enjoyed the tournament. And that is representative of so many people, right? So with that,
absolutely.
As a franchise, is there, I'm curious of this, the basketball side of the X's and O's, and then on top of that, is there a challenge in finding the balancing act of being able to take advantage of the marketability of Caitlin Clark, understanding all of the focus that comes with it, allowing that to grow the brand of the franchise, but at the same time, trying to insulate a little bit, making sure that she's able to make the acclimation and is treated day in and day out like all of the other players on the roster? How do you balance that, and is it challenging?
That is a great question, and that is a question that we continue to discuss ever since we heard the word late February that she was coming into the draft. How do you balance all of the things that are going on in the Caitlin Clark world? And I think it's all about time management. It's all about rest. It's all about recovery. It's all about surrounding her with a really great support team and doing everything we can to help her acclimate to what she's going through.
Hall of Famer and general manager of the Indiana Fever, Lynn Dunn, is our guest. Lynn, everybody that has looked at Caitlin Clark's profile going into the draft and now going into her rookie season with the Fever have highlighted the fact that there is, much like the men's game, a jump of physicality, a jump of pace, a jump of speed when you go from the college game to the pro game. From as much as you've seen of this sport, what areas of Caitlin's game will translate immediately, and what areas will she be tested out of the gate?
I think you're going to be surprised how much of her game will translate. You know, her ability to shoot the logo threes, her ability to make unbelievable passes. She's physically stronger, especially in her core and her legs, than most rookies are. So that's going to really help her handle some of the physicality. She's also played soccer. She's got a real good concept of angles. And I think she's a little bit more prepared than most rookies are.
For you, and you've seen so much film on her, but what about her, both as a person and as a player, excites you the most? Because I know Jake was, you know, joking with Clark Candy Bars, and we could feel the giddiness from afar of what this would be like for this night to arrive and for the Fever to land such generational talent. But well, what aspects of her, both the player and the person, excite you the most to have her involved in this community?
I think it's probably her tremendously high basketball IQ. This is a very, very intelligent young woman. She's mature for her age. You saw what she was able to do on the spur on Saturday Night Live the other night. She handles all the interviews like she's a pro. So she's a pro on the court and off the court. She's far beyond where you would think a young person would be at this time in her life.
You know, with that, Lynn, one thing about Caitlin Clark, and I want you to tell me if I'm off base here. It wouldn't be the first time. But in watching her, I think we get caught up. We live in a world now. We live in a TikTok world, right? People get caught up in 30-second snippets of things and sometimes lose focus of the bigger picture. And we see shots of Caitlin Clark hitting 30-foot jumpers from the logo that barely move the net. And I think that with that, what we don't see sometimes is her movement away from the basketball, but more so her vision. She has kind of a Gretzky-esque vision of anticipating where the ball needs to be as opposed to where it is and getting it into operating areas for others when she is guarded. Is that, have you noticed that as well?
Yes, you're exactly right. She has the gift that very few have. Gretzky's a good example. Curry's a good example. Sue Bird, who played for the Seattle Storm. John Stockton, great players that saw the game 2 or 3 seconds ahead.
Right.
They knew where the player was going to be ahead of time, and they were able to deliver the ball there. And that is a gift.
Another thing that I've noticed about her, there is clearly within Caitlin Clark, Lynn Dunn is our guest of the Indiana Fever. With all players, there's a competitive streak. In Caitlin Clark, there's a competitive streak that you can almost see, you know, boil over before our eyes. And I think you always want that competitive streak. But do you have to channel it at times so that it doesn't become counterproductive?
She's highly competitive. Have you seen some of the videos when she was a little kid playing? I mean, she was a terror. I think what she's done in the 4 years at Iowa is she's learned to handle the frustration. She's learned to become more composed, handle the pressure a little bit better. But I like that fiery inside of her. I like that fierceness that you can just see it boiling over. That's what comes with being a highly competitive player.
Lynn, how unprecedented is the level of scrutiny, of micro-analysis, of game-by-game breakdowns of a player of her caliber in the history of the WNBA? Like, how unprecedented is this territory that we're entering with the way she's been covered? Certainly she's experienced it her entire Iowa run. I'm not saying she's going to be not used to it, but from your seat, how unprecedented are these waters?
Unbelievably unprecedented. We've never had anything quite like this. Now, we've had some great players. We just haven't had the visibility in the past. People, you know, they weren't tuning in, and there on national TV was women's college basketball. So thank goodness women's college basketball with the great package deals. The Big Ten did a great job. Now they're visible. Now you're seeing what these young women can do. But what Caitlin Clark's done with her chasing all these records, breaking one after the other and the next and the next, and then chasing Pistol Pete Maravich, it just got everybody in the world involved in wondering when she was going to break the next record. So it's totally unprecedented.
How much will you lean on, Lynn? Just, you know, I saw that Caitlin Clark yesterday had talked about the thrill that she had in one of the first games that she went to, I think, and she was able to see Tamika Catchings play and what a thrill. Or I know what it was. Tamika was doing one of her games and she couldn't believe that Tamika Catchings was there. You know, it was such a thrill for her. With Tamika still being an active part of the community and still, you know, part of the franchise, just being around, will you lean on maybe Tamika being able to mentor her with the expectation that Tamika also had in joining into the NBA?
Yes, and that's a great point. We've got three key players, Tamika Catchings, Tully Bevilacqua, and Karima Christmas, all played on championship teams. Both Tully and Tamika were Olympians. And so they're all here in town. They're all associated with the Fever. And so she'll have these three who have been down the path, not with the visibility that she has, but they'll be a tremendous resource for her.
What was going through your mind last night, seeing the level of support, not just Hoosiers, but Iowans in the mix as well, that made the journey to Gainbridge last night for that watch party?
Well, to be honest with you, I was stunned. Somebody had said we were going to have a big crowd, and I thought, okay, maybe a couple of thousand. And then when I heard there were like 10,000 plus people in Gainbridge for a draft party, I was like, so I had to go out there and see it to believe it.
Lynn, listen, I've got a $1 million idea. Do you want in on my $1 million idea? Do you want a business partner?
I always want in on a $1 million idea.
Okay, here's my $1 million idea. I mentioned this on the radio, so hopefully nobody has stolen my idea yet. Along I-74, somewhere like around Danville, Illinois, I'm going to open up, you know, like a Holiday Inn Express type hotel, but the entire lobby I'm going to decorate in nothing but Iowa/Indiana Fever stuff. Because of the people from Iowa that are going to be coming like 20 times a year and staying at my hotel. Because my assumption is that this is going to be a ticket base that is going to extend beyond 465, correct?
I think you're exactly right. You might want to open more than one Holiday Inn.
See? It's my $1 million. And by the way, the little concession stand next to the ice machines, nothing but Clark bars. And yeah, Boston Baked Beans.
Right, and get you some merchandise now. Make sure you got some jerseys and t-shirts.
I know, they've sold out already, right?
That's right. Fanatic sold out in an hour last night.
Now, what about, you know, there's going to be so much, obviously, attention here. But at the same time, I want you to tell me, Lynn Dunn, you know, we talked about your other picks last night, and we know Aaliyah Boston is a great player. But what else about your roster and the way that it came together maybe towards the end of last year? Maybe it didn't manifest in victories, but what about your roster did you look at and really start to like that you think fans will enjoy beyond the obvious, you know, buzz of Caitlin Clark?
Well, let's remember we went from 5 wins in 22 to 13 wins in 23. So we made significant progress. I think Aaliyah Boston is going to be a key factor, and Alyssa Smith is. But let's not forget Kelsey Mitchell, who is one of the all-time leading scorers in the history of the Big Ten. So when you start adding together Clark's points that she scored in college plus Kelsey Mitchell's, we got a lot of points out there. And I think Caitlin's ability to deliver the basketball to her teammates, she's extremely unselfish, is just going to make this team even that much better.
Which do you believe, Lynn Dunn, is harder when building a team and when you're a player? Learning how to be a champion, or once you become a champion, sustaining the same drive?
I absolutely think sustaining is probably harder than anything. Once you win, once you reach that top of the mountain, staying up there is 10 times harder.
Lynn, let's go back a decade when you hung it up from your Indiana Fever time. You go to Kentucky for 6 years, and then you take over as general manager 2 seasons ago. Did you ever think that, obviously the game's growing year over year, but did you ever think that the Fever would be in this position where it's dwarfing every, like Jake made the comment earlier, the BBC's calling the fan to have somebody to talk about Caitlin Clark and how she's going to impact Indianapolis. Did you ever think we'd ever see something like this?
Not in my lifetime. You know, I've always envisioned when we passed Title IX 50 years ago that this day would come. But I didn't know that it would come in my lifetime, and it's overdue, past time, and I'm sure that it's coming here.
You know, Lynn, one of the things that's interesting to me, Lynn Dunn, our guest, in this conversation alone, in talking about your roster and in talking about Caitlin Clark, we haven't talked a lot about her shooting and her scoring ability. In other words, correct me if I'm wrong, and I know that you love a player that can score, don't get me wrong, and she can absolutely shoot the basketball, but it does sound like priority one for her is going to be facilitator, and that is Aaliyah Boston's team, right?
Yeah, she's a point guard. She has a true point guard mentality, and that doesn't mean that she's not going to look to score, but she's also going to look to set up her teammates, and she has that built-in mentality, and I think that makes her special.
Now, I want to know what you did last night to celebrate.
Well, they popped the champagne. I gave up alcohol about 10 years ago, so I popped a bottle of water, and everybody else around me toasted the number one pick.
All right, I like that. You know, when I was – Lynn, listen to this. When I was in middle school, our football team went undefeated and the parents all brought in sparkling grape juice for us to spray, like as if like we were the Boston Celtics or the, you know, the Indiana Pacers or whatever. And I look back on it now and it was great, right? I mean, it's not alcoholic. It was Welch's. And then I think to myself, I don't know that you could do that today. Wouldn't parents get in trouble if they did that today to simulate the champagne spray for kids?
Yeah, I suggest they not do that.
Well, you know what? Hey, the bottled water works just fine, right? I mean,
yeah.
Whatever works, works. Listen, Lynn, I know how much people are excited. I know what it means. You know, the people that I was most excited for last night are, and it's great for basketball fans in Indiana. And I said last week, I'm like, folks, I'm telling you, this is Peyton Manning level in terms of marketability within this city. But I'm happy for people who have young girls that are starting to play basketball, because what you've done is assemble a roster of girls that the young girls, guys too, but that young girls can look towards and really admire, and role models within the community is, you know, what young people need. And I love the fact that that's what you guys are building, and I look forward to seeing what you guys can do.
Well, I'm happy for them, but let me tell you who else I'm happy for. I'm happy for Rick Fuson. I'm happy for Kelly Kroskoff, who invested in this franchise 25 years ago, to the Simons, the entire Simon family, in particular Herb and Steve now, who've been invested from the get-go, probably the one of the best owners in the league, and now Herb's going into the Naismith Hall of Fame. So big thanks to them for their support all these years.
They'll have the banner up in the rafters that says Hall of Fame right next to the one for Lynn Dunn that says the exact same, right? So
I hope so. Come on, Herb. Come on down.
I like it. Lynn, we appreciate it. Enjoy that Clark candy bar today, and then it's time to get to work, right?
I sure will. Thank you, guys.
I appreciate it. Lynn Dunn, the general manager of the Indiana Fever, always a good conversation. Always fun. Joining us on the program now, he is our friend from the Indianapolis Star, talking about the Pacers, Dustin
Dopierak.
Thank you. And he joins us now. Dustin, how are you?
Doing well. Well played. Well put together.
Well, listen, it's taken, how long have you and I known each other? 3-4 years, easily?
Somewhere in that range. I probably did some stuff in the first go-around in Bloomington, so who knows? So somewhere 3-4 years. There might have been some before that. I don't know.
I figured after 125 radio interviews, it probably would be, you know, I don't know, mature of me to get your name right. So we just did it that way, right?
It works. It works. It's effective.
Let's begin with this. We've talked about this a lot today, Dustin. In your thoughts and opinion, you know, there are varying opinions on that. Do you think that Indiana is anticipating seeing Giannis at least for the first half of this series?
I know Carlisle, I think, said this morning on the radio that they were looking at it as if they would. Obviously, whenever you see a Woj report, you presume it's true. And obviously, Wojnarowski from ESPN reported this morning that the Bucks don't expect him to be ready for game one and game two. So we talked to Rick a little bit about that at practice. And basically his thing was, like, don't know if he's going to play or not. We're going to prepare as if he's going to be there because he's Giannis. You have to be prepared just because if you're wrong, you'd rather be wrong at him not play than wrong at him play. But his view was, like, they're still good if he doesn't play. You know, there's still talent there. I mean, he particularly mentioned, Bobby Portis, who's played, you know, very, very well in his absence for the most part. Is making a pretty good case for sixth man of the year. I imagine it'll be Malik Monk, but I imagine Bobby Portis will, you know, finish top three in that discussion. He's been pretty effective, and obviously they still have Damian Lillard. They still have, you know, Chris Middleton and some other talented guys. So, but I think their view is, you know, Brooke Lopez, et cetera. So their view is you prepare for him, you act as if he's going to be there. So if he's not, you're still expecting a pretty tough game. So I don't think he's going to play in game one. I don't know. You know, game two is a maybe. I think after that, you presume game three, game four, game five, he's available. But I would think he's not going to play game one, but I think they're preparing as if just in case anyway.
You know, regular season head-to-head certainly gives you an idea, right? It gives you a barometer. Mm-hmm. But, Dustin, is there a danger in dwelling too much on that? New season, experienced team versus relatively inexperienced team with all that changes and ramps up in the postseason. Can we dwell too much, and is there a danger in it on, you know, November, December?
Yeah, I mean, I think there would be a danger, I think, if they were buying into that entirely. I mean, they've been pretty clear about, like, hey, it's been, you know, you haven't played them in 3 months. You're both totally different teams. I mean, the Bucks have a new coach, and the Pacers are very differently constructed. I mean, they added Pascal Siakam since, and obviously they lost Buddy Hield, Bruce Brown, you know, Jordan Nora, you know, Benedict Mathurin. You know, so they're two very different teams from the teams that last met on January 3rd. So their presumption is, I think the value in it on the Pacers part is, hey, we have beat these guys. I mean, it is different, but all the same, like, you can't look at them like they're, you know, 10 feet tall and bulletproof. You beat them 4 out of 5. You have to go in with that level of confidence to know that you can do it. You don't view yourselves as that big of an underdog. You don't feel like it's not possible for you to pull this off. But from a, can you do the same things you did last time and win? You can't, because you're different. They are different. They're going to be better at some things. They're going to know what's coming as far as your transition offense, how fast you want to run. They're going to know that. They're going to try to slow you down. So you got to presume that what you were able to get easy, you know, the first couple times, you're not going to be able to get easy this time. It's, you know, same thing goes on the Bucks end. I mean, they know that, you know, the Pacers aren't going to give Giannis 54, 64 points in a game. I mean, they're, you know, the last time they played, I think they put basically three guys on the foul line and said, you know, just dare him to drive through all three of them and just say, okay, like, we're not going to let Giannis get 50. So I think both sides have to know that, like, they're not going to be playing the same basketball games, but I do think, obviously, the confidence of knowing that you have beat these guys before matters a lot, especially if you're going to a playoff series for the first time in 4 years. It just gives you something to not feel like this is bigger than life.
Pacers beat writer for the Indy Star, Dustin Dupirak, is our guest. Dustin, when I look at the Milwaukee Bucks without Giannis Antetokounmpo, I see a team that is middle of the pack, maybe sure, back half of the pack in the Eastern Conference. Am I being too harsh on that sentiment? And with his absence, you have to get one of those two games if he misses the first two, right?
Yeah, you really do. You got to find a way to get one of those. I mean, you know, I mean, would they still be a playoff team? I mean, probably. Like, there is still talent there. I mean, you look at the rest of their roster. If you just, you know, take all the honest, obviously, you know, Damian Lillard, this isn't the best season of his career, but he still averaged 24.3 a game. You know, he's still Dame in those, you know, late moments where he can, you know, really take over down stretches, you know, can get to the foul line, can hit big shots, you know, distribute. So you're still dealing with a top level player. And obviously Damian Lillard has been able to win, you know, playoff series, you know, not on his own necessarily, but, you know, has taken over late playoff games when he was in Portland. You know, Brook Lopez is obviously one of the best defensive centers in the league and still hit threes from the outside. Bobby Portis can do a lot of things. Chris Middleton obviously isn't healthy frequently, but he can burn you when he is. Malik Beasley, I think, has become one of the better, you know, pure shooters in the league. And so they still have pieces. Jay Crowder, Pat Connaughton, and Patrick Beverly is a pain. You know, they have pieces that can be a problem for you. So you have to presume that they are going to be able to cause you issues. Are they a team that you look at and say is dominant and that should be a title contender? No, you know, not necessarily. But, you know, they, like, it's can they beat you in two games? You sure can. But, I mean, if you are going to be playing a series against Milwaukee where they have home court advantage, but they're going to be missing, you know, a two-time MVP, all-world, you know, all-historical world type player, you know, you have to find a way to get them then, because you're not going to have, you know, that's an opportunity you can't pass up. You got to find a way to beat them when they don't have Giannis.
Stylistically speaking, we've talked a lot about the Pacers, their pace of play. Malik Beasley has said it's going to be a different style. It's going to be a different feel when these two teams meet in the playoffs, as he was, you know, speculating if they were to ramp it up one more time, building off of the regular season series. With Giannis off the board for however many games, who does that favor in your mind in terms of the style of both these teams and the pace at which the Pacers want to play?
I mean, I still think it favors the Pacers. I mean, I think basically it's this. I mean, like, the conventional wisdom is that the game slows down in the playoffs, and Milwaukee's going to do everything they can to make sure it does. You know, that being said, Indiana is going to make sure they do everything they can to make sure it doesn't. And, you know, I mean, what makes the Pacers' tempo really something is they don't just push off of, you know, off of misses and off of steals and turnovers and stuff like that. I mean, they want to break right back at you if you make a bucket. If they see you celebrating too long, they intend to come right back at you and run at you. They're going to force it if they have to. And so that, you know, so do I think Milwaukee will be able to slow them down from how much they want to play? Yeah, but do I think Milwaukee will be able to slow them down to the point of where they want the Pacers to play? You know, probably not. So there's still going to be some transition opportunity. The Pacers will probably still be playing as fast as anybody else is in playoffs.
Dustin,
they might not be Dopierak. They were.
Sorry, darn it. We jumped over there. Let's try that again. Dustin
Dopierak.
Thank you. Of the Indianapolis Star is our guest. Sorry about that, Dustin. I didn't mean to cut you off with your own words. Tomorrow, we just lined up. 1 o'clock tomorrow, TJ McConnell is going to join the program. I want to give you the opportunity, Dustin, to talk about what TJ McConnell has been able to do in the final, let's say, quarter of the season. What is different about his game that has really elevated to the point of, you know, just the contributions he's been able to make as the clear now number two guy coming off the bench at the point guard position?
Yeah, and I think the biggest, I mean, he obviously recognized the fact that once you took, you know, when Benedict Mathurin got hurt, he was the only guy who could really break down a defense off the dribble. You know, they could really attack off the bounce. I mean, certainly they've got other guys who can score in that second unit, you know, with Obi Toppin and Jalen Smith and, you know, Ben Shepherd to a certain degree. But basically, you know, it was more or less when you had McConnell and Mathurin, they could both just attack you off the bounce. He didn't have to do it all the time. He didn't have to be the one guy focusing on that. I think he realized, all right, you know, that sort of burden was on him once Mathurin was out, and it was just like, okay, he was going to just attack. And he kind of found out that, man, when he really does that, when he's getting downhill, there aren't a lot of defenders who can guard him. There certainly aren't a lot of second unit defenders in the league that can guard him. And he was special. I mean, just his incredible ability to stay in perpetual motion and find a way to get to the paint, get to his spots, and make shots. Was incredible. And he was still distributing and still a pain on defense like he is. But he was able to step that up and really, you know, sort of see a vacuum and sort of an opportunity, but also a requirement that somebody was going to have to be able to break defenses down and get them scrambled if they were going to maintain the level of pace that they were playing with and that they were able to still be able to score in the paint, you know, but also get kickouts, just basically just make that offense continue to work at the speed it was working. You had to be able to break somebody down off the dribble, whether you were kind of coming at them in transition or doing so in a half court set. And he really did that. I mean, he's just so good at getting, from the perimeter to wherever he wants to in the paint, whether he's finishing at the rim or if he's taking that little 5-6 foot pull up. And the effectiveness is really something else. I mean, I think he comes in, 14 out of the last 15. He scored in double figures. I mean, his average is way up. I mean, I think he was somewhere right around 20 per 36, which is a crazy number. It's just bigger offensive numbers than he's ever had. It shows him the man's just in immensely good condition, and in a league of human beings that are in incredibly good condition, he's the guy that can run circles around all of them, and that's really incredible. So he's just had, one heck of a season. I mean, they're a different team without him, and they still ended up, even after losing Mathurin, after trading Hield, really losing a lot of firepower off that bench, they're still the leading bench scoring team in the NBA, and TJ McConnell is a huge reason why.
Dustin, we know how different these two teams are since they last played back in January. You highlighted that a little bit at the beginning of our conversation, but when you look at Bobby Portis and you look at Brook Lopez and what those two bigs do for Milwaukee and what they'll be asked to do in terms of guarding assignments, which Pacer, with this influx now of Pascal Siakam, which Pacer big or which Pacer that stretches the floor presents more matchup problems for them? Is it Pascal Siakam or is it what Miles Turner brings to the table?
I mean, it's a combination of the two. And I know that's a cop-out answer, but it
totally is, but I'll allow it. That's okay.
it's a total cop-out answer. But, I mean, Brook Lopez likes to play and drop. You know, I mean, that's really kind of his big thing is he's one, maybe the best drop defender big in the league. And you play and drop and you open up the possibility for Miles Turner to burn you from three and from the mid-range. It becomes a problem in both of those cases, and that's why he's been so lethal in pick and roll. With Tyrese Halliburton is that he can beat you at all three levels. If you're not going to let him go all the way to the rim, with a head of steam, then okay, he's just going to shoot over top of you. And he has legit three level scoring capacity. So when he's on, he can be a real problem even against that kind of coverage. So he, as good of a defender as Lopez is, and if Turner was going right at him, you're probably taking out a lot of the pain points. It's going to be probably harder for him to score at the rim. So Miles is going to have to make shots, but he still is a problem because he can stretch the floor and hit threes. And Pascal is just Bobby obviously is gonna have a good shot at him, and I think he's a pretty good defender for that matchup. But I mean, Pascal really just finds ways of posting you up and just finding a way of shooting over you. And the length the man has is really something that basically you can be all over him in a post up, and he can just turn, fade, and there's nothing you can do to get a hand on a shot, and he can make it. So they're both trouble. Again, both those guys are pretty good defenders. again, Lopez is one of the best defenders in the league. But Turner and Siakam both present sort of major problems for each matchup. And again, I mean, I think, you know, Siakam is the better player, and Siakam presents matchup problems for anybody because it's just so hard to keep him from doing what he wants to do. You know, his moves around the rim are tremendous. He's got just phenomenal handles for a guy that's as long as he is, and then he can shoot over top of you. And the combination of those two things make him really, really hard to guard around there.
Dustin, to me, one of the impressive things about Indiana, and I wanted you to maybe let our listeners know how this has come about, or those that are responsible for this, or tell me that I'm off base in my observation. But I think what Indiana's done in the last month to 6 weeks that's been impressive is it's been able to kind of reinvent itself with a more aggressive defensive approach or commitment, maybe a better word, but sure. Done so while also finally not letting it compromise its offense. I thought for a while there was a stretch where it was one or the other, right? And now they're able to clamp down defensively while still kind of playing at a higher pace. What are the tweaks that went into that?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is just fully integrating Siakam. I think there is just like when they made the change in January to put Jalen Smith in at the four, you know, that just cost you a little bit. You know, obviously he's able to shoot well enough to play the four, you know, but he's a five body wise. He's not going to be able to, you know, it's not like he can't run the floor like he can. He obviously gets his transition buckets, but, you know, he's not playing as fast as Obi. He's not playing as fast as Pascal. You know, when you're talking about getting up and down the floor, when you have, you know, two guys that can really rim run. I mean, Obi is just one of the best there is at rim running. And I think that sort of clogged up the amount of pace that they were able to play with. And, you know, you're just kind of going in all in on size there, basically. And then sort of in the in-between, obviously, you bring Pascal in, but then you have that transitional period where, you know, Tyrese Halliburton's hurt, you know, and then he's on a minutes restriction, and you're just not the same team. You've got this sort of in and out, you know, movement of lineups. It's really been since the break that they've had, okay, you know, you've got Pascal and you've got at least a healthy Halliburton, and then you have Halliburton goes on a slump and he's having a hard time getting any buckets, and you're not necessarily the same team. So finally, as Halliburton's kind of got out of it, you know, they've been able to run the same way, and you have kind of what you've baked in on defense. So you've got and I think, you know, some of it is guys are playing tougher. I mean, I think Siakam has defended much better over the last month or so than he did over the first month and a half or so that he was there. I mean, I think he's certainly got the length they've needed. He yet didn't necessarily wasn't that effective early, but I think he's playing more physical. They're definitely taking advantage of the fact that they're letting, you know, refs are letting a lot more go and they're playing a lot physical and a lot more, a lot tougher, but they just have lineups that can run. Whereas like, I don't know that initially when they, you know, dedicated to playing a more defensive lineup at Christmas, they were giving something up and they knew there was a trade-off. And with Siakam, being able to play Siakam and Toppin at the four on the first and second units makes it less of a trade-off at that position. And so you still have all the defensive pieces there and you're not losing as much on offense.
What's your must hit in Milwaukee? I mean, you're going to be up there for a couple days, right?
Right, yeah. I never get time to like really spend time around the Deer District. Like there's some cool bars over there, you know, like I only got to go to one, I think. Like I've barely had time to just stay there. So I'm just looking forward to like just being able to chill around there. It's nice that everything's close.
Awesome. Let me tell you, here you go. You ready?
Yeah.
I'm going to answer my own question for you since you have no design to get to, cause you're right. I mean, it's a cool place. There's a lot of stuff right down there, like on by the Water Street. Cause there's like a river that goes through. Okay.
You should check out Culver's.
Yeah. So you walk out of the Fiserv Arena, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Literally three blocks away. So this would be the equivalent of leaving Gainbridge Fieldhouse and walking to, I mean, I don't know, like Prime, basically. I mean, not very far.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
Three blocks away, 9th and Juneau. Just remember the Alaskan capital, Juneau. 9th and Juneau, you will see the overhang over the street of the original Pabst Brewing site.
That's awesome.
And then right when you walk towards it, as you're walking up the hill to the brewing site, you'll look to your left, and you see a little neon sign in the window, and it's gleaming, Dustin. It's like an oasis.
Gleaming.
And it's gleaming, and it's saying, Dustin, please come patronize me. And you walk in. This is what happened to me when I was in Milwaukee like 7 years ago. And I walked in, and it is the original Pabst Brewery, and this guy named Jim bought it and turned it into a bar, and at that time they had three things on tap: Blatz, Schlitz, and Pabst. That was it.
Nice.
It's now been turned into, it's a super cool place with like an event center, and they have a restaurant in there and everything else. There's a restaurant right there. There's the Milwaukee Brewing Company is across the street. It is one-stop shopping for anything that you need for the evening, and there you go. Go there.
Glorious.
Say, hey, Jim, the radio guy in Indy that can't pronounce my last name told me to come by, and Jim will take care of you, and he'll set you up. He might even let you have a beer in Captain Papp's office.
Nice. Fantastic. What's the name of this place?
It's called the Best Place at Pabst Brewing. If you just go to the Pabst, if you go to the old Pabst Brewery, you will see it. You can't miss it. And Jim's the guy that runs it, and I think I was the very first customer in there, and every time I go in, he's like, oh, yeah, the radio guy. And yeah, it's great.
I thought you were going to send him to the Hershey's plant.
No, the chocolate factory. Now, Dustin, I'm going to tell you, as I've divulged on radio many a time, you've seen the Jeffrey Dahmer documentary on Netflix, right?
I have not watched it, but I know of it.
Okay. So Jeffrey Dahmer worked... He was an overnight worker at a chocolate factory in Milwaukee. Okay. And when he, got a little sideways and went away for a while, the chocolate factory closed, and it's still in business, but they tore down the location where he worked, and it was just an empty lot for a long time. Imagine any of the restaurants in downtown Indianapolis in the last 5 years, for example. You walk past and you're like, oh, there used to be something there. Same thing.
Miss you, champs.
And eventually they built a new site on the chocolate factory. It's now called Fiserv Arena. And when the arena opened, the first event that they had there was a concert, and it was the Violent Femmes and the Killers.
Wow.
Total coincidence.
Jeez.
Yeah. Man. More than you were asking for there, wasn't it?
Man, that is something else. Now, I would have gone to that show. That would have been a great show.
Totally.
Like,
hell, I'd have gone to the Chocolate Factory.
Independent of what's there. Yeah. But, like, that's...
Now, if you want to know where Dahmer lived or where his grandma lived, let me know. I'll send you the address.
All right, I'm going to get the entire Jeffrey Dahmer documentary here.
You got it, man. I'm telling you, I've done the whole thing. At La Cage, I've been there, too. That's the bar where he met many a people. Been there.
Wow.
Just telling you, more than you asked for. Just stick with Best Place.
Many
how's that?
People
just walk up to 9th and Juno, and you could stick right there by at Best Place. Yeah.
All right, perfect.
All right, so that again is our friend Dustin
Dopierak
of the Indianapolis Star. Dustin, appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Indiana is a state that is known for having great sports icons. And one of them that many of you may not know, I think most people are aware of the name, but may not know the total legacy and heritage and contribution to life of Carl Erskine. Carl Erskine is an Anderson native, a native of Anderson, Indiana. And Carl Erskine grew up playing basketball in Anderson. And by the time he was 9 years old, started playing baseball more actively, doing so in the Anderson City Leagues. And realized that was the game that was going to build a life for him. When Carl Erskine was drafted and began playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and this is inconceivable by today's standards, he went out to Brooklyn and lived in the YMCA in Brooklyn for a while. And one of the first teammates that he met while playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers was none other than Jackie Robinson. And Erskine, who had seen segregation, who had seen, different areas of racism and division in Indiana as a boy, but had African-American friends and teammates before he got to the Brooklyn Dodgers, saw Jackie Robinson as a teammate and saw that, I guess, as an eye-opener of you take from people and you judge them by what they provide as humans, not by other aspects beyond their control. That later benefited Carl Erskine, who became a fabulous pitcher for the Dodgers, who threw two no-hitters, who threw the first no-hitter televised in the United States, who won World Series. And the lessons that he learned from Jackie Robinson, he talked about greatly when he talked about trying to help his own son, Jimmy, that was born with Down syndrome, overcome the stereotypes of what people saw that Jimmy couldn't do as opposed to what Jimmy could do. And Erskine used those lessons for a life spent bettering things for people that needed that. The thing that I loved about Carl Erskine, while I did not know him, was that from the outside looking in, he appeared to be a man who dedicated his life to giving voice to the voiceless, which I think is the ultimate gift of humanity that one can provide. Joining us now on the program, a guy that made a film, The Best We've Got, which was a documentary about Carl Erskine. Ted Green is with Ted Green Films and worked tirelessly on that, telling the story of Carl Erskine. The Erskine Green Institute is now a program throughout based in the Anderson and Muncie areas to help people that have disabilities in bettering their lives and learning adult skills. And Ted Green joins us now. Ted, first off, condolences to you, because I know at the age of 97, a great life well and long lived for Carl Erskine, but you knew him well. And when you know someone well who has those kinds of contributions of life, you seemingly want them around forever, and you lost your friend today. So first off, condolences to you.
Thank you, Jake, so much. I tell you, even though certainly I knew it was coming, it's hit me harder than I expected. And just a little bit ago, a Special Olympics Indiana athlete called me and tried to encourage me and say, you know, you have to stay strong for Carl's wife, Betty. I think that's when the emotions really started flowing. I was able to be with Carl and the family yesterday. You know, and he was near the end, but I got to kiss his head and tell him I loved him. And he squeezed my hand a little bit. And, you know, what I'm feeling right now is like I'm the luckiest guy out there that I got to learn and share this great man's story.
You know, Ted, so often with people, you know, we know about athletes, right? And we know about the great contribution of athletes and the fact that, you know, here's a guy that played with Jackie Robinson and was part of the, you know, he was one of, I believe, 5 or 6 remaining living Brooklyn Dodgers, right? So you're talking about walking history right there. But then I think that the way that people, and maybe sometimes people like Carl Erskine's greatness is defined by this, but I want you to elaborate on it. Sometimes people, when we look at the contribution of their work, we realize that it's actually the contribution of their humanitarian side that allows them to, in fact, be larger past life than in their life itself. And the legacy he leaves behind goes far beyond baseball. And quite truthfully, Ted, is probably more important.
Oh, there's no question. A remarkable life in so many ways. And I say probably the least remarkable thing was his brilliant baseball career. You spoke really eloquently a little bit ago about you know, Jackie Robinson and what Carl did, you know, or helped with Jackie and his friend Johnny Wilson, you know, back in the 1930s Indiana when every societal force was pushing him away from Johnny because he was a black kid and Carl was a white kid. And yet, you know, they came together. And then for, you know, 80 some years after that, they were a beacon of hope. Up there in Anderson, there's a new mural that's going to be dedicated soon with the two of them on it. But I mean, you know, Jackie, I spent some time during the production. We went to film Jackie Robinson's tombstone, and the words on it are, "A life is not important except in the impact it has on other lives." You know, to me, that was Carl to a T for 97 years. I mean, and I think you can look at it, his service to others, especially those who have felt the sting of discrimination, Johnny and Jackie. But I think his probably his greatest legacy will be in the realm of people with intellectual disabilities and the treatment and the respect afforded them. Indiana, at the beginning of the 20th century, was among arguably the very worst state in that regard. Today, it's among the very, very best with just an incredibly strong Special Olympics Indiana program. And everybody who knows, who understands the evolution, will say, yes, of course, it took a village. But if you're going to point to the two people that made the biggest difference, it was Carl Erskine and Betty Erskine with their son, Jimmy.
You know, Ted, if you go back, and I believe Jimmy was born in the early 60s, if I'm not mistaken.
1960.
And he passed away in, what, 2023, within the last year or two?
Last fall.
If you go back, Ted, and you look at, and it's terrible to say, but it's a dark reality in this state notably, when people would have children in the 40s, 50s, and 60s in Indiana that had, whether it was hearing impairment or intellectual impairment, you know, Miskatonic Hospital, for example, it was not uncommon that it was, okay, well, the hospital will raise my child, and that was that. And it almost seems, and I don't mean this to come off the wrong way, Ted, but it seemed perfect that Carl Erskine would be the parent in that situation because he had the grace, the understanding, the compassion, and the voice to be able to say, no, that's not how we're going to do this. And to blaze that path that then opened it up for so many people and continue to do so. I just saw today the Erskine Green Institute had two of their recent graduates going out into the workforce working in a hotel in Muncie. And that's something that speaks to a 60-year effort. And in the end, when you look back on it, it seems like it was almost perfectly meant to be. Does that make sense at all, what I'm saying?
No, it does, because, you know, there were other very, very brave parents back then. You said it wasn't uncommon for a child with intellectual disability to go into a facility, what they called them, for the feeble-minded back then. It was actually quite common. The opposite was very rare. So the fact that Carl did have, you know, the name he got from baseball helped in that regard. But you have to understand, even with that, this was a day-to-day struggle. That's something I really learned during my research. I mean, a lot of people will go out there and they'll throw their name to a cause. And, you know, athletes do this all the time. And some get a little bit involved. Well, this was Carl and Betty's life for all 63 years of Jimmy's life. I mean, Jimmy was supposed to end up 30 at best. Well, he lived till 63. He worked at Applebee's for 20 years. He competed in Special Olympics for 50. You know, honestly, it's not an overstatement. When you see somebody now with Down syndrome, perhaps at the grocery store, you know, maybe doing some bagging or whatever, or you see people out in the community, when you think of that, that's because of people like Carl and Betty Erskine. It was a ground up fight, and they did it. And he, you know, he's the most humble guy you've ever known. He'd never want to take any credit, but it just comes to him because it's deserved. You know, I can't imagine anybody who would have championed a cause better and have better results than Carl Erskine.
Do you think Carl Erskine, Ted Green is our guest. Ted Green Films, his work, of course, the documentarian he did, The Best We've Got, which is about Carl Erskine. Our subject today, by the way, the Green of Erskine Green Institute is Steve Green, the former Indiana basketball player who partnered in name along with Carl Erskine to help get that program launched. Ted, do you think that Carl Erskine, given his choice, I guess, would rather sit around and talk about his time, 11 years with the Brooklyn Dodgers, his two no-hitters, his World Series victories, his 14 Ks in a game? Would he rather do that or just break out his harmonica and play the national anthem or take me out to the ball game?
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, the man loved telling old baseball stories. I know a lot of guys, grown men, who would make the pilgrimage up to Anderson just to sit there in this, you know, little house with Betty and Carl and just listen to them tell the same stories year after year after year. But to your point, they wouldn't leave until he broke out that harmonica and played something. I mean, at the very end of the film, we have him playing back home in Indiana. You know, he played, I certainly played at Pacers games many times, at Indians game. He'd play the national anthem. He played Take Me Out to the Ball Game on Jackie Robinson Day. They put it out, I was out in LA for this, in Dodger Stadium. They put it on the Jumbotron. The man got such a kick out of the kind of the simple things in life. And, you know, every year I would get a birthday call and he'd be playing Happy Birthday to me. I mean, you know, it's almost like it's impossible to kind of draw up a guy like that. You think that's from a different time, maybe a time that never really even existed. But it's just so heartening finding these qualities, finding these impact in probably the most humble guy you'll ever see. And, the fact I consider Carl a North Star. Certainly, I mean, I would say nationally, even internationally, but especially here in Indiana.
Ted, Mitch Daniels, the former governor of Indiana and, of course, president emeritus of Purdue University, issued a statement saying the following: you didn't have to be a lifelong Dodger fan to be a huge fan of Carl Erskine and the remarkable character with which he led his life. When asked by his documentary filmmakers to sum him up, I blurted out, he's the best we've got. I can't prove on that, and like millions, I'll miss him very much, end quote. Daniels, of course, talking about your film. Daniels, also a noted lifelong Dodgers fan. Ted, I know that you're going to join Greg Rakestraw at 4 o'clock. I will let you guys get more in-depth about the incredible legacy, the life well-lived, and your close friend, Carl Erskine, but I wanted to give you the opportunity here for us to touch on Carl Erskine as well, since this news is just coming out within the last couple of hours before we got on the air. So I know you and Greg will have more in-depth and heartfelt conversations about Carl Erskine, Ted, but I appreciate not only your time today, but also your efforts, your work in preserving the legacy of Carl Erskine via film and word for people to enjoy. So I appreciate the time today.
Thanks so much, Jake. I mean, I'm a sad guy today, but I'm also the luckiest guy. And I think that this is Carl's a celebration of everything that's great about Indiana.
Well said. Appreciate it, Ted. And look forward to hearing you with Greg as well coming up at 4 o'clock today. Again, Carl Erskine passing away. The best of us indeed, and a true baseball and sport icon here in Indiana.